this remembrance that the lens that you see the world through, the lens that you see yourself through, is not a fixed one. And you can change that set point. You can change how you perceive things.
Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we're talking with author of the book, Don't Hate, Meditate, Megan Monahan, a good friend of mine. We're talking with Megan about letting go of our past and how meditation can help us unpack traumatic experiences and other difficult situations that we've been through so that we can let go of our past and move on to create a dynamic future. You don't want to miss this podcast. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Megan Monahan. Megan is a meditation teacher and author and is passionate about making meditation accessible and relatable. Her goal is to infuse a modern-day realness into the all-too-esoteric landscape of meditation. And that's what we're going to be doing in this conversation. Since learning to meditate in 2009 with Deepak Chopra and becoming a Chopra certified instructor, she's taught thousands to meditate through her platform. She works with corporate brands like Lululemon, Chopra Global, Unplugged Meditation, and Wanderlust while working privately with personal and corporate clients internationally. Always bringing up her spiritual real talk. Her first book, Don't Hate, Meditate, was published this past June by 10 Speed Press. Megan, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to have this conversation.
What does meditation look like these days for your private clients and the places that you teach in the midst of a global pandemic?
Right? I know. It's sort of like the Super Bowl that I didn't realize I was entered into as a meditator.
I like that. It's like you've been warming up for this.
I've been training for this. It's, for me, I think anytime, but especially right now, it's really a non-negotiable to have a sense of agency over your mind and to have a great deal of equanimity. And I think for a lot of us in the world, we've been able to sort of coast on autopilot and lean into things outside of ourselves to feel happy, to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel loved. And what I think we're all seeing in a way that feels like deeply uncomfortable at best is that all of those things, all of those external outlets that we plug into, all of those roles that we play, all of those material things, they're all really impermanent. And every time you meditate, I like to say it's like plugging into yourself and finding that outlet that is never taken away. And the more that you can charge from that place, the easier it is to still feel okay. Maybe not as great, but to still feel okay when those external sources are taken away or aren't quite as accessible. And so for me, that's what I've been really trying to support people with during this pandemic is just how do you develop that sense of equanimity within yourself? And how do you develop that relationship with your mind where you're not automatically opting into every single thought that you have, every single thought someone else has, because it's really, I think, necessary to be regulating that right now.
You know, we talk about filtering our water and eating clean food. And really, in a way, it's like meditation is that filtration process for our brain to really allow what's true to rise up and what's not true to just slowly just pass on its own because there's not this constant stimuli that's keeping it alive. So before we continue on, I want to make sure that we don't lose people because you have a real gift for real talk when it comes to meditation. And the real talk around meditation is that there's a whole subset of the population that feels like, I've heard about it, it's not for me. It doesn't work for me, it's not for me, I'm not interested. And a lot of that comes back to they think they already know what meditation is and isn't. So I want to start off with, what is meditation not? What is not
meditation. Let's talk about some of those common myths that people have about what meditation is, but it isn't that.
So the number one thing that I hear, and all of you come up to me or you spiritually slide into my DMs and you think that you're going to get out of meditating by saying to me, "Hey, Megan, I tried to meditate. I tried to stop my thoughts. I tried to silence my mind and I just can't do it. So thanks, but I can't do it." And I will happily retort with, as long as you have a pulse, you're going to have thoughts. Meditation is not about stopping your thoughts and silencing your mind. I don't know who created that soundbite, but it has just been haunting all of us teachers forever and ever and ever at this point. So be really okay with the fact that you're going to have thoughts in meditation. I like to say that meditation is, it's almost like eavesdropping. So, you know, if you can recall a time when you were in public, remember when that happened, and we would, you know, be overhearing a conversation. Maybe you're in a restaurant, maybe you're on a train, maybe you're just out in the world and you overhear a conversation. Most of the time, you're not going to jump into a stranger's conversation and input your thoughts, right? Because that would be strange. That's kind of like what meditation is. Meditation is when you get to start taking a step back and just eavesdropping on the activity, eavesdropping on your own thoughts, eavesdropping on sounds that you can hear or physical sensations in your body. And it's just creating that space between you and that activity and practicing doing that while you're meditating, and then taking that sort of mental strength, that awareness outside of meditation, and putting that into practice when you're in your waking state. But meditation is not about stopping your thoughts. Number one thing that I hear. So if that's your excuse, sorry, you have to meditate right now.
You know, you say you're not, if I could just jump in for a second, you say, I'm not really sure who put this out there. And I want to say that I think that a lot of early meditation teachers put it out there. Even sometimes, you know, I think everybody means well, but I would even sometimes early on, I grew up with meditation sort of baked into my tradition, and I was forced to do it when I was younger. I totally resisted. I had no idea. I thought it was a waste of time. I'm glad I had that background and experience. But I can remember reading early books when I actually started to get into meditation. I remember seeing and hearing the Dalai Lama, you know, sometimes say like, clear your mind of all thoughts, right? Hear other meditation teachers, or this sort of, you know, you have this idea of the person who's up on the Himalayas that's like, his mind is all clear, her mind is all clear. And so I think that that kind of came from like the early meditation community.
Yeah. Well, I'll be sure to have a word with them, because I think
talk to the Dalai Lama. I know you guys have your standing meeting every week, so I'd appreciate if you could chat with him.
Yes. And I think we need to break this down. Yeah. And you know, maybe there's a version of that that can be interpreted as true, but for our modern world, it's definitely not true. So be really cool with that. The other thing that people say to me a lot, and it'll happen after class or after I'm like with a client or whatever it is, they'll say, "Oh, that was a really good one." And I always stop them and just reframe that a bit, because I think we have this expectation that it should feel really relaxing, that we should have some insight, that we should maybe have some aha moment, that maybe we have some clarity, maybe we feel a deep sense of stillness that we have access to all of a sudden, that there are these very cool meditation-y, very technical term, moments that you can have when you meditate. And it's cool when those happen. If any of those things I just described show up, if you see colors, if you, you know, feel a connection to yourself, that's really dope. And those meditations are really fun. But that meditation is just as good as the meditation that I did this morning where my fire alarm went off in the middle. They're equally good. One was just more fun. One was more enjoyable. The only bad meditation is the one that you don't do. So I think the other myth that I would kind of dispel is that nothing needs to happen for it to work in the moment. You just have to do it. Not unlike working out. You know, if I go out for a run, there will be days when I am running and 2 minutes in, it feels like I have never run before in my life. And it's so laborious and painful. And then I have the days where I feel like I could run a half marathon. Both of those runs were equally beneficial. I just liked one of them more.
So you're basically advocating for the removal of judgment on a meditation.
Yes. Let go of the expectation.
Because what happens? So to just push it a little bit, what happens when we do say that that was a good one, or somebody says, oh man, I really needed that, that was a good one. What's the fear or what's the concern when somebody judges a meditation as good or bad?
So number one, I think with any kind of judgment, it stops being a neutral place for you. And I think one of the biggest blessings of meditation is that it's this kind of neutral landscape that you get to rest in. So I think if you have an expectation, there's already a sense of meaning that you're applying to it that isn't going to serve you. And then I think you set yourself up to almost have an out, which I'm not a fan of. I think we should all meditate every day for the rest of our lives. So if you have, you know, a string of meditations where it doesn't feel great and you're kind of antsy, or where you hear the leaf blower every time, or where the dog is bothering you, then all of a sudden, oh, it's not going well, I'm going to stop doing this.
Yeah, it's the fear that, well, not so much the fear, but it's more just sort of paying attention to, if we're so critical on each one, the time that we don't end up having, you know, what is like an enlightening moment, and then all the clouds part ways and the birds are chirping outside after a meditation, we won't continue to put in the work, was where really all the benefits come from.
Right. And then, and lastly, to just double on that point, the benefit of your meditation, for the most part, will reveal itself outside of your meditation. So, you know, I always say to people, hopefully your meditation is relaxing. You know, if you're meditating with me, I have a very soothing meditation voice. I'll put on some ambient music. It will hopefully be more relaxing than other parts of your day. But the reason that you're meditating is for the other, you know, 23 hours or, you know, 23 and a half hours in your day. You're not meditating for that moment. That's not where the dividends show up in your life.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote by Alan Watts, which I'll paraphrase here because I don't have it in front of me. He says, you know, the goal of dancing is not to see who can get done dancing the fastest or to be best at it or rush the song. It's just to enjoy the dance, enjoy the play, enjoy how it happens. And with meditation, sometimes it's not about doing it the longest or to have the best version of the meditation. It's how can we see the results and the fruits of our labor in other areas of our life. I think another one that comes up often is you need a ton of time.
Yeah. Which is untrue. You only need 72 minutes each. No, just kidding. No, you can definitely, you know, there's a lot of science that they're really just starting to do now on like micro meditations and, you know, 2 minute, 3 minute mindful moments, even 20 seconds at a red light, breathing deeply, that can be really beneficial. You know, a lot of the science that's out there now tends to be it was for 8 weeks and it was for 12 minutes a day. You know, there's a lot of that, but I think we're going to start seeing more and more science as well on just like micro moments of mindfulness and how that helps you continue to have a mindful state of being, because there's the mindfulness meditation technique, and then there's being mindful, and being mindful is when you are present, when you are aware of what's happening around you without immediately judging what's happening around you, which is a game changer. So I think we're going to start to see more of that.
So if the goal is to pivot from the common myths and reasons that people think that they don't want to meditate or don't have interest in it or would prevent them from starting in the first place. So if the goal is not to have the best meditation and that the results of the meditation come out in our regular everyday life, what are actually the results? What are the things that we all deal with on a daily basis that are either difficulties or challenging times that meditation can potentially improve?
Yeah. So I think it's really important to, and this is one of the things that helps you start meditating and continue meditating. I think it's really important to identify where in your life or where in yourself you feel a sense of imbalance or you feel a sense of pain, whether that's physical or emotional or mental. It's important to know why you're sitting down. Meditation feels very intangible. I am the first to admit that it feels a lot like sitting and quote unquote doing nothing until you start to see those benefits show up. So I think in order to see the benefits, you have to get clear on what you're looking for. So I started meditating purely for stress. There was nothing about my journey into meditation that had to do with connecting with my purpose or rediscovering who I really, really was. I didn't have any awareness of that, nor did I really care about any of that. It's kind of like an adaptogen herb where meditation will kind of show up everywhere, but you have to kind of notice it. So I would say, number one, think about that within yourself. Where are you looking for a shift? Where are you looking for more balance? Because it shows up kind of everywhere. It will help you change your relationship with the stimulus in your life, with the stress in your life. It lengthens the fuse between the stimulus and your response. There's that really famous line, and I'm blanking on who said it, but it creates a space between the stimulus and your response. And so it lengthens that fuse line between the thing that's happening and how you decide to react. And all of a sudden you have that choice to decide how you want to respond. And through that, you begin to break some of your conditioned thinking and the conditioned cycles that you've always acted in. It will help you be more present. So a lot of people start meditating for anxiety, which is certainly, I think, relatable right now. We do a really good job at following our mind wherever it wants to take us. And a lot of times that's back into the past or into the future. And if you are anything like me, and I've been meditating for 12 years, I don't often find my mind wandering back into the past just to like a really great day to give myself an extra jolt of happiness. I don't often have anxiety about how great everything is working out and how am I going to handle all of the blessings that will undoubtedly shower me. I really should think about that and overthink about that. Usually we go to like the constriction. So one of the things that will start to happen is that you'll innately be more present and you'll be able to notice when you leave the present moment and have more agency over if you actually want to follow your mind there.
Because our brain has its own negativity bias that was designed evolutionarily to protect us.
Yeah.
And it's natural that we're going to return back to painful situations or hurtful situations or times where we felt insecure or we're judging ourselves now or worrying about something because our brain has been hardwired for that. And if we want to create a new wiring and a new programming system, that's where meditation can come in.
Yep. Yale did a really great study on how it affects meditation, how it affects your default mode network, right? That monkey mind, that self-referred mind that's thinking about you, and really the part of you that wanders, especially to the future. So as you start to meditate, there's a decrease in how much that default mode network impacts where you are. And we have more, as I said, more agency over where we're going, and it becomes a choice. And it doesn't always mean that you're going to be your best self, but I find that when I start to do that, when I start to go down a rabbit hole, when I start to, you know, follow an old neural pathway, which, you know, is conditioned to think the worst or feel some sort of constriction, when I start to do that, I know that I'm doing it. And if I let myself go there, I know that I'm letting myself go there. And I find that I can only kind of handle myself being ridiculous for so long before I stop and bring myself back to this moment, bring myself back to my power. So meditation absolutely will show up there if you have some relationship with anxiety. It also, you know, and there's a ton of science around this. Harvard did a really powerful study that showed the amygdala, one of the parts of your brain that really activates that fight, flight, freeze stress response. And through meditation, there is a decrease in the brain cell volume of your amygdala. And I kind of like to think of it as increasing your comfort zone. So it takes more to kind of send you into that space of, I'm not okay. I don't feel safe. I better activate all of those primal instincts to stay alive, right? Which we do all the time inappropriately.
So you mentioned earlier you've been meditating for 12 years. Sometimes people really respond to information, which is what we've covered so far. Sometimes people really respond to stories. So I want to talk hero's journey and jump into yours.
Yeah.
Give us the beginning part of that and what led to meditation.
Well, I was born a month early on a sunny day in July. No, just kidding.
Were you actually born a month early?
I was born a month early. Yeah. And
there you go.
I do a lot of research and I listen to a lot of podcast episodes that you put out about things, about, you know, immune system things. And anyway, that's another conversation. But I was born a month early. So I started meditating in my early 20s. I was working in the music industry at the time. I'm also from New York. So just for reference, that's why I now have to teach meditation for a living to undo all of that conditioning. And as I said, I started meditating purely for stress. And the majority of my stress at the time had to do with my relationship, which was a very codependent one, with my father, who was amazing and loving and one of the most important people in my life, and also an alcoholic. And at the time, his health was severely declining because of his alcoholism. And there was a point when we went to his doctor, and doctors don't usually give you a kind of prognosis like this, but the doctor said, yeah, you probably have about a year to live. And even though I intellectually knew that, you know, my dad had been an alcoholic my whole life and he probably wasn't going to, you know, live into the time that I would like him to, hearing that was some sort of activating agent and just sent me into a tailspin. And I started having all of these physical symptoms of this emotional toxicity that I definitely had spent 22, 23 years just ignoring, just kind of bypassing, and I'm finding my way through. And, you know, to the point that I had to get my gallbladder taken out from gallstones from stress. I had chronic hives for about a year. I started having all these autoimmune issues that weren't going away. And my therapist at the time, God bless her for having this insight, she said, you know, I don't think you need to be on Xanax. I don't think you need to be taking something. I don't think that this is a chemical issue within you. I think you just need to process some things and learn how to digest your stress differently. And from that session, I will never forget this. I went home and I Googled, this is how little I knew about all of this. I Googled wellness, Southern California. And the first thing that came up was Deepak Chopra's Wellness Center, which was at the time down in San Diego. And I called my mom and I said, do you know who Deepak Chopra is? Because I don't. And his center looks kind of cool. And long-ish story short-ish, I ended up going down there for a day just to kind of check it out to see if I bought into any of this. And I took an intro to meditation class. And I remember thinking, wow, the guy who's teaching this class is really hot. Maybe I could like date him. Maybe I should come down here and maybe this is like who I'm going to end up with. And that was a whole fantasy. Again, very new to this whole world. And I had a mind-body medical consultation. And it was the first time a doctor had ever talked to me about my health in a way that embodied my mental health, my physical health, my spiritual health. And I drank all of the Kool-Aid and ended up going back down there for a week and did Panchakarma, which is, an Ayurvedic cleanse, and learned about meditation and started meditating and doing yoga, and it changed my life. And then that became a whole trajectory. And within a year and a half, I was working there. And within a year after that, I was a certified teacher. It was very much a quick road to where I am now. Yeah. And that was about 12 years ago.
So I want to go back to a couple parts in that story and that journey. Do you think that the doctor's goal, when he had shared that prognosis with your father, who, you know, you've shared later on, ended up passing. Do you think that the goal was at that time to get your, drove you to stress, but I think that was the doctor's goal to give you and your dad, specifically your dad, a wake-up call in the way that it was shared?
You know, I don't know. I think that, you know, in my memory, I remember someone asking him, and I think it might have been my mom. And I don't know if, I don't remember in what context that was shared. I don't remember if he said that to all of us or just her, but I don't know what his intention was. You know, I'm thankful because even if it wasn't, you know, the quote unquote best thing to share, because, oh, by the way, he lived for like another 3.5 years. So it wasn't so much, you know, you're in stage four of this thing and this is how long people usually live. It was like, well, your liver's not doing great and you have hep C and that's not great. It was more just like a general, it's not going well. And like, maybe you've got around a year. But I'm so thankful that he did, because it ended up being a wake up call for me to get a glimpse of how much I was just shutting out a huge part of my life and a huge well of just stuff that I hadn't ever really looked at.
You know, so much of meditation is helping us step into the place of focusing on what we can control and the realization of reality, which is that there's a whole bunch of things we can't control. You've mm-hmm. shared very openly in other conversations and talks that as meditation had entered into your life, and even when your dad got this prognosis and he lived longer, part of the gift that you were given in stepping into what you can control is there was this forgiveness that was brought into your relationship with you and your father. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And I have a whole chapter in my book on acceptance, because acceptance was something that I had a really hard time with him in relation to him and his alcoholism. I was constantly, when I was young, I was constantly fighting with him about why are you doing that, and really fighting with reality. You know, Byron Katie, who I know you appreciate as well, has that great quote. I am a lover of what is, not because I'm a spiritual being, but because it hurts when I argue with reality. And I spent 22 years arguing with the reality that my father was an alcoholic. And rather than consciously accepting that that's who he was, and then deciding what kind of relationship do I want to have with this, accepting you as you are, I fought it, and I fought with reality, and we always lose when we fight with reality. And it took me getting like sucker punched with that prognosis to get knocked out, and then to wake back up and say, okay, and I have these tools now. And as I started meditating, I felt a sense of compassion for him that I hadn't ever had before. And I was able to not take his actions that weren't even about me, not take them so personally. And through that, and through a sense of non-judgment, I was able to accept him for who he was. And rather than being upset about who he wasn't, I was able to come to a place where I could appreciate how he did show up in my life and the love that he overwhelmingly shared with me and showered on me, and let go of the idea of what I thought it should be and what I thought it should look like, and really truly accept him for who he was. And it's the thing that, as you said, like one of the things that I am the most grateful for in my life is getting to that place while he was still alive, and being able to like look him in his eyes and tell him that is something that I will be so forever grateful for. And oh, by the way, through that healing, I also found what I feel is my purpose in life. You know, I found myself, I found a really authentic self-worth that, and self-love that isn't dependent on how someone else is doing, someone else's well-being, which is, you know, so much of what codependency is. So in all these ways that my father's alcoholism wasn't ideal and wasn't what I quote unquote wanted, it has been the catalyst and the vehicle for literally the best parts of my life and the best parts of myself.
You know, sometimes, and I think there's a lot of people, whether they're parent or a loved one struggled with any kind of substance abuse, or whether there was other factors that were there. And everybody can relate, and it's obviously a spectrum, but everybody can relate to the feeling of life was happening to me this way, I wish it was another way. And especially with loved ones, that's a universal thing that so many people go through. And I want to acknowledge that it's far more traumatic for some people than others. But of course, everybody still goes through it. And in that period, I think there's some people that are listening to this podcast and hearing your story and feeling just a deep sense of, you know, a big heart for you, for your dad doing the best that he can, you know, what was his upbringing like, you know, what struggles did he go through, and also looking at their own journey and then wondering, like, amazing, that sounds awesome. I would love to bring acceptance into my life to this thing that I have not had a chance to accept in from the past. Now, I'm curious for you, when people hear that story, how do you talk about the layers of the onion and the time that it took? You know, did you have an epiphany one moment in a meditation? Is this years? Is it a zigzag process? How was it for you in terms of the ultimate place of getting to acceptance and using the path and the vehicle of meditation?
Yeah. So I did really intense work. And I also, you know, am so privileged that I was able to go and learn from someone like Deepak Chopra, go and learn from someone like Dr. David Simon, who is the late co-founder of the Chopra Center, that I had access to teachers and tools. So that's not wasted on me. But one of the biggest elements of that work very early on, when I first was involved with the Chopra Center as a guest, was doing a 3-day super intensive program that was all about, you know, mental and emotional release. And it involved a lot of process work, a lot of, as you were kind of touching on, a lot of, like, you know, writing my dad's story, you know, putting myself in the position to look at life through his eyes and coming to that place of truly coming to that place of, you know, if you are acting like this, if you are treating yourself like this or your loved ones like this or your whatever like this, I can't even imagine what it must feel like to be in your mind or in your heart, because no one wants to feel that way. No one wants to act this way. So, and then there was a very profound release ceremony and ritual that we did. And it took time to fully, you know, release and accept and forgive and all of that. But that was a huge moment for me to start to authentically release and forgive him. And it's just, you know, there's that line that's really been credited to, like, several people, but it's mostly credited to Gandhi, I think, where, you know, when you hold on to anger and resentment, it's like drinking poison and expecting your enemy to die. And, you know, that's really what I was doing. I was holding on for 22, 23 years to resentment, to I wish you were different, to this is why you're not good enough, to judgment, to all of that constriction. And it was only hurting me, you know, and I don't have a gallbladder now because I held on to that resentment. But once I started to let that go and started to feel a sense of lightening within myself, within my heart, within my body, it was just such an incredible affirmative sensory thing that I just kept doing it. And I just kept leaning into that. And also once I started doing that and started to feel less codependent, started to feel less threatened by his well-being. Because, you know, really, I think there's such a misconception about codependency and that it means you don't want to be alone, which is so far from the truth. It really is just that your well-being and your sense of okay is very much linked to how someone else is doing. Your ability or your misconception that you can control other people's feelings and kind of manage the situation, all of that was very much what I grew up doing. So once I stopped doing that and could really just be within myself, I started to have an identity that was separate from him, which also was quite freeing. So, you know, I think the other part of this that was a big part of that journey to forgiveness is rediscovering who I am, you know, because I think, again, we plug into the relationships, we plug into where we're from and what we do and, you know, who we're with and where we live, all these things. And that's who we are. And if that's who we are, then when that relationship goes away, part of you goes away. If that's who you are, then when you get fired, part of you goes away. And it doesn't mean that you can't care about all these external, you know, expressions of you. But through meditation, I started to connect with that part of me that, you know, can't be threatened. The part of me that won't ever get fired or that, you know, can't ever be broken up with or that isn't tied to those physical. And again, it doesn't mean that those don't mean anything, but there's a real sense of power and peace that comes when that's who you are.
You know, that's, first of all, that's so beautifully said, and thank you for sharing that. I have one more question, because I think acceptance is such a beautiful theme in your story, and it's really what a lot of us are looking for in our lives, and it's inside of us. In your story, we were talking about how the vehicle of meditation was one of the methods, in addition to the additional work that you were doing down there at the Chopra Center. It was one of the main methods and the central methods that helped you peel away these layers of the onion, put yourself in your father's shoes, and, you know, the forgiveness that's brought into him. What did you have to forgive yourself for? Was there anything that you had to just say, like, you know, pick up Megan, the little girl who's doing the best that she can? And how did meditation help you see that and step into that?
Yeah, 100%. And part of that really intensive, like, 3-day, you know, retreat that I did was about identifying and apologizing to him, you know, in this context that I was in. And I think it starts with, through meditation, you have this ability to notice your thoughts. You have this ability to just be the witness to the story. And I was able to really acknowledge the story that I was telling myself, which was very much a victim. This is happening to me. This is why I'm messed up. This is my relationship with love. This is why I'm not good enough. This is, I mean, there was a lot of that that was very, that was just very seductive. You know, those stories are quite seductive and very easy to get addicted to, because you can blame a whole lot on a story like that. And it really allows you to just sidestep a lot of personal responsibility, it turns out. So while that's convenient, I don't recommend it long-term. And, you know, I absolutely had to forgive myself for the way that I treated my father, you know, from, you know, parts of middle school, through high school, through college. I was not treating my father with unconditional love, with kindness, with compassion, with understanding, with empathy very often, you know, and that felt, once I started to soften into a place of authentic embodied compassion for him, it was just heartbreaking thinking about some of the things that I've said to him, thinking about some of the ways that I treated him. And I'm not saying that the way that he was treating me was quote unquote okay, or that I was okay with it. You know, I think it's really important to remember that you acknowledging something doesn't mean you're endorsing it. You can accept what is without liking it. It doesn't mean that you're on board with it, but I definitely very rarely up until meditation accepted him and what was. I very much had a story about it, in a way that I was a victim, in a way that this was happening to me, and how dare you. And I had to absolutely come to terms with that and sit with that and let that go as well. And again, I'm so happy that I was able to do that while he was alive, so I could, you know, apologize for those things. And I'll, you know, I want to be clear, that doesn't always take the other person. Closure doesn't take two people. So if you're listening to this and it's resonating in a certain way, but that person isn't in your life, either because it's not healthy for that person to be in your life or because they're not around, you can absolutely give yourself closure like that. You can write a letter. You can do a lot of this work even without the other person, which is helpful.
Thank you for sharing that. So I want to pivot into the different types of meditation that are out there. It's kind of like, you know, diets. Everybody has a way and a methodology and approach and is an advocate for what they want to do. How does one begin to navigate what type of meditation modality do they want to use for themselves?
Well, I think we can all agree that mine is the best. So let's just do that. No, just kidding. I think, there are so many. I think it's really important, almost more than the modality, to find a teacher that you resonate with. I think I think a lot of them are quite similar, whether that's having a focal point, whether that's your breath, whether that's the silent repetition of a mantra, you know, visual meditation, sound. There's so many, as you said. I think finding a voice that you resonate with, that you can connect to, that you can opt into is one of the biggest barriers, because holding space for yourself, and that's a very like esoteric LA woo-woo term, but holding space for yourself, creating the container for your meditation that you can then relax into, can be quite hard. It's like working out. So, you know, I've worked out with a trainer. Working out with a trainer is very different than doing the 10 things that the trainer told me to do when it's our off day and I'm supposed to do it myself. Guess what? I'm not going to do very well on my own. 25 burpees three times. Guess what? I'm not going to do very well. All those things that I don't want to do. And yet when my trainer, shout out to Frank, when my trainer is standing there and he says, do 25 burpees, I'll do the burpees because he's holding that container for me. So I think whether that's going on an app, whether that's finding a teacher, whether that's reading a book, there are lots of ways to have that container held for you. And while that isn't always necessary, I never want to be the teacher that says you always need me or you always need my book or that app or that recording of mine. That's not the case. But in the beginning, while you are building that strength, that's really helpful. So I would say that. I would say rather than trying to pick the modality, find a voice that you resonate with, that you enjoy kind of relaxing into, and start from there. I mean, I will say, I guess to couple with that, I learned meditation with Deepak Chopra. So my initial lineage was mantra meditation. I will say that I'm obviously biased to that because it's the first thing that I learned that changed my life. No big deal. But I will say that mantra meditation, if you are someone that has a very busy mind, like all my New Yorkers out there, I will say that mantra meditation felt really effortless for me because you're giving your mind a thought. You're giving your mind this one thought in Sanskrit. So it's a meaningless thought to silently repeat. And that's what your mind wants. Your mind wants a thought. So I will say that I'm biased to mantra meditation for those of you that are like, my mind is so busy, I can't sit with my breath.
I would love, and we're going to do a meditation here in a minute that we can take our audience through. So I'm excited about that. And that's not a mantra meditation. That's a mindfulness meditation. Mm-hmm. I think we were chatting earlier. Yep. So I can't wait for the audience to get a chance to experience that. I want to talk about the book real quick before we get a chance to go into that meditation practice. Where did the impetus come from for writing a book, and how did you want to present meditation in a way that you didn't see it out there?
Yeah, I love my book so much. It was so exciting the way that it came into my life. It's one of the things that I can use as an example for manifesting. And I'll just briefly say that it's so important to, and you can do this through meditation so well, to start to connect with why you want the things you want. Because I didn't, quote unquote, want to write a book. I really wanted to share my work with more people. In Sanskrit, we would call that the sankalpa, the desire that's whispered from your heart, not cognized by your mind. And I think we get really stuck sometimes in the material version of the desire. And the more that you can connect with the root of the desire, like why do you want the thing you want, you open up this path of least resistance to get there. Getting a job working for Deepak Chopra, again, I didn't try to get a job working for Deepak Chopra. I never even applied to work for Deepak Chopra with no experience in wellness. Oh, by the way, I really wanted to help people transform their lives the way mine had been transformed. So the book definitely talks about manifesting and trust and all of that. But that's how the book came about. I was approached by a publisher who literally said, hey, have you ever thought about writing a book on meditation so that you could share your teachings with more people? And I said, thank you for asking. And yes, I have. And it didn't end up working out with that publisher. But through that, I picked up a lot of spiritual breadcrumbs along the way. And within a few months, had spoken to a book agent that was helping me write a proposal. And within, you know, 4 or 5 months, I sold that proposal and signed a book deal and wrote a book 6 months later as someone who wasn't really like a writer before this. So to bless it on manifesting, connect with why you want what you want. And as long as you can see yourself on the other side, just trust as you are moving through like the journey of that desire's manifestation, trust that you'll get there. So yeah, I wrote a book and it was really important to me to kind of bridge the very esoteric conversation with the like superficial spirituality. And I think that there are a lot of resources for the deep work. And I think we have a lot of really, sometimes really good, but very superficial. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but in a less substantial way, access to spiritual teachings or teachings on meditation. And I really wanted to bridge the two. I wanted to have a book that gave you depth and that gave you a practice, but also gave you really tangible and like entertaining and fun ways to explore how meditation will show up in your life. So that's what I did with the book.
You know, anytime anybody who's writing their first book and they're putting it together, there's always different feelings that show up. It could be fear of how it's going to be received. It could be imposter syndrome. Can you think of any new challenges that you faced while you were writing and putting together your book that were different? You know, you hadn't maybe gone through them in the same way, and how meditating through the process helped you kind of get perspective on them.
Yeah, I definitely had, you know, parts of my old story that weren't serving me, which was, you know, worth. So am I really, who am I to write a book? Like, you know, not quite imposter, but kind of imposter, you know, is this going to be a good book? I'm not a writer, quote unquote. A lot of those thoughts were definitely showing up and they were quite unhelpful. I also didn't have, so we talk about meditation and not having an expectation of what it will feel like to meditate. I definitely had an expectation of writing this book and what it would feel like and how it would look. And, you know, I would book hotels for the weekend and have these grand visions of me going to this like great hotel room on the beach and writing all weekend and waking up at 4 a.m. and just downloading what the universe wanted me to know. And every time I did that, I spent the whole weekend thinking about writing and not writing a thing. And it was challenging. It was definitely pushed me. It definitely challenged me. And I had to continue to lean into such a deep state of trust, which is why that was my favorite chapter to write. That was like the first one that I wrote pretty effortlessly. I had to deeply trust that I had manifested the seed for this desire, like pretty effortlessly. And I had to trust that because I could see myself having written this book, I could see this moment that you and I are having where I'm talking about the book, or I could see myself on stage, you know, teaching from this book, because I could see that so clearly in my mind, or I could imagine it. I'm not sure which one it was. I just kept trusting that along the way, I would evolve into the person that I needed to be, into the writer that I needed to be to write this book. And I started to just let go of the expectation as I got into it. I let go of the fear. I let go of the story. And here we are.
You know, and isn't that the main reason that we all take on projects besides making a difference and wanting to impact people's lives? We take them on to see who do we have to become, or who or what version of our more true self do we have to step into to bring this project to fruition. Not that it's going to be easy. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of challenges along the way, but that's where meditation comes in. It supports us through the process. So, Megan, the book is out. Don't Hate, Meditate. You can find it in the show notes if people are listening.
Audiobook. If people are more audiobook right now, especially during this quarantine, you can have, I don't know how many hours, but a lot of hours of my voice and in the meditations audio as well.
I love that. I have not heard of the audiobook. You were kind enough to drop off a hardcover early version of it. And I just remember it being designed really beautifully.
Oh my gosh, it's so cute. It's so cute. It looks so good on a table with a candle.
Yeah, well done. Well done to make it visually beautiful as well too. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about how our audience can stay in touch with you and follow you and everything else like that. But first, I'm going to pass it over to you because I'd love you to take us through a meditation.
I would love that. So we'll just do like a casual, like what, like 70 minute meditation, just like an easy in and out. No, just kidding.
Easy, easy peasy.
No, is it cool if you meditate for like 8 or 9 minutes?
That's cool.
Is that
That's
a good
perfectly
amount of
time? Cool. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, good. So the number one thing is to be comfortable when you meditate. We tend to not do things over and over that are uncomfortable. So you do not have to sit like you've seen meditators sit if that isn't what is comfortable for you. So just check in with where you are right now. And if it's safe for you to do so, wherever you are listening to this, I will invite you to close your eyes. If you can't close your eyes, just find a focal point that you can rest your gaze on. And let's just start by taking a few deep breaths together. Long, slow inhale through your nose. Open mouth, audible exhale. Again, long, slow inhale. Exhaling everything out. Let's do one more breath together. Deepest inhale yet. Pausing at the top of that breath, holding for 4, 3, 2, letting everything go. And then allowing that breath to become natural and relaxed, moving in and out through your nose. And just beginning to become aware of this moment through a lens of acceptance and non-judgment. Become aware of any sounds that you hear. The sound of my voice. Maybe there's an awareness of the subtle sound of your breath. Maybe there are sounds in your environment. Just beginning to notice what you notice. Start to become aware of what you can sense with your body. Maybe it's the points of contact where your weight is being supported, where your hands are resting. Maybe you begin to sense the feeling of the air on your face, your skin. Maybe you can sense your heartbeat, that light pulse in your chest, in your arms, in your fingertips. Maybe you've noticed that you're still breathing. And begin to just gently rest your attention on the sensation of that breath. Begin to feel that inhale and exhale in your nose. Notice your breath there. Begin to feel that breath in the gentle rise of your chest as your lungs fill with air. That sense of release as you exhale and everything falls. Notice your breath there. Feel your breath in your abdomen, that subtle expansion and contraction. Notice your breath there. And then just rest in that general sensation of each breath in and each breath out. Feeling that ebb and flow. And begin to become aware of the space that exists in between each thought, in between each breath. So notice the moment after you exhale, before you take that next breath in. Notice that moment after you exhale, before you take that next breath in. Maybe even counting the moments that reside in that space between. Continuing to find your way to that space. If you notice that your attention has been pulled to another thought, to a sound, to another sensation in your body, through that same lens of acceptance and non-judgment, just notice where your attention has gone and gently find your way back to that moment after you exhale, before you take that next breath in. Notice where your mind is. Gently find your way back. And continuing to rest in that space for a few more moments here. being reminded that every breath you take offers you that moment to pause. That moment to rest for just a moment in that inherent stillness and silence that lives in that space between. Every breath you take offers you the ability to come back to this moment, to come back to yourself, and to decide how you want to be and who you want to be in that next breath and in that next moment. With all of that in mind, one final deep breath in, sighing everything out. Letting that breath gradually become a little bit deeper, carrying you back into your body, back into the room that you're in. And when you're ready, allowing your eyes to float open gently. So that was a 10-11 minute meditation. Definitely something that is doable and sustainable, I think. How'd that feel?
That was great. Thank you, Megan.
Good. You're welcome.
It's, you know, it's always nice to talk about meditation, but when you can actually bring it in and remember the feeling, it's like working out after a long time after not having working out for many people who have meditated before but haven't done it recently. And nobody needs to convince you or give you any kind of information about why it's good for you. Just kind of feel it inside.
Yeah. I just think too, it's really hard after you meditate to not see things. Like I always look around and things look like they've been put into HD. Things within me feel more manageable, feel slower. It's just, it's such a great way to just totally shift how you're seeing what's around you and what's within you, which is such a subjective thing. And the other thing that I really wanted to offer in my book, just this remembrance that the lens that you see the world through, the lens that you see yourself through, is not a fixed one. And you can change that set point. You can change how you perceive things. And there's that great line by Wayne Dyer, you know, when you change the way that you look at things, the things that you look at change. And that's the greatest source of power, I think, that you can yield is having agency over how you see things. So I hope that meditation becomes a tool for all of you to do that, because it has transformed my life and it can absolutely do the same for you.
Beautiful. The book is out there. Don'tHateBook.com. Don'tHateBook.com, where you get the audiobook at that same location too, and you can find it in the show notes. Megan, where else can our audience keep in touch with you?
So I do a lot of Instagramming. You can spiritually slide into my DMs anytime. My Instagram is at Meg Monahan, and I'm doing a lot of virtual teaching now. So definitely head over there and follow me, because I'm posting all of the things there.
Ah, amazing. Megan, thanks for being not only a great guest, but an awesome friend over the years. We've got a chance to work on a lot of really fun projects, and I just appreciate how you show up in the world and how you're always there for people and bringing this good vibes and good energy of the vehicle of meditation to so many. not just in the Los Angeles community. So I want to acknowledge you and thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you so much for having me, and right back at you. I adore you, and I'm so thankful that you are in my world.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.